This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net.
Your book, Our Airwaves, yes, it's true. Anything is possible when you advertise with the RightsCast Network. Hey there, I'm R.R. Campbell, RightsCast Network founder, and I'm here to let you know that you can now advertise your book, podcast, editing services, whatever creative endeavor, you can advertise it here on the RightsCast Network. Not only that, but you can advertise with us for less than a dollar a month, yes. We offer packages for as little as less than a dollar a month. So get your book, your editing services, podcast, what have you, introduced to hundreds of new listeners by advertising with us today at rightscast.net/advertise or email me at rightscast@gmail.com and we can get started. Let's make it happen for you and your creative endeavors. That's your book, Our Airwaves, rightscast.net/advertise. This is episode 14 of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network. Welcome to the RightsCast Network's Novel Approaches podcast, a craft-focused conversation for writers everywhere.
Because writing novels is hard, and we're all in it together.
Hey there, I'm author, editor, and RightsCast Network founder, R.R. Campbell.
And I'm Sione Ashleman, freelance editor, David Bowie fan, and co-host of the Novel Approaches podcast.
This time on Novel Approaches, we'll examine inciting incidents, what they are and why they're important, the shapes they take, and how to write them effectively. But first, Sione, we survived the Rev Pit submissions window.
Yes, we did. Always a intense week.
Yes, it gets to be a lot of pages read, a lot of words read, a lot of great interaction on Twitter as well, but it is it's an intense time. It's an intense time.
Do you go through withdrawal when it's all over because you've gotten addicted to Twitter?
I don't know. My withdrawal is more of I'm just used to checking this year we had a spreadsheet, right? It used to be all the submissions ended up in our inbox. So I just kept going back to that spreadsheet for a couple hours after I knew the window had closed and was like, oh, more submissions, right? More submissions. No, there are no more submissions. You've seen all the submissions kind of thing. So I found myself gravitating back toward that is my home base for all things Rev Pit this year.
Yeah, that was pretty neat the way that we did it this year. But yeah, so Rev Pit, and I'm working with my author now, and I'm so freaking excited. I'm working with Vaishna Patel on The 10 Incarnations of Rebellion,
ooh,
which is an adult alternate history set in Mumbai.
Oh, wow.
And it's a dual timeline narrative for very good reasons. I'm going to tweet about it at some point here, probably over the weekend. But yeah, it's like if the British had not left during that whole Gandhi thing.
Yeah, just that whole Gandhi thing, you know.
That whole Gandhi thing. But instead had stayed until 2011.
Oh, wow.
And I'm just like, I don't know. There's so much awesome to say about it, but I won't spend too much time here. But so that is going on. But the main thing I'm like, aside from editing work and working with Vaishna, I'm thinking ahead to this summer because I have a couple like pretty exciting things on my plate. One of them is I'm getting an intern.
Oh boy, fancy.
I know. It does make me feel very special. It's someone from Lewis and Clark College, my alma mater. Okay. And did I say that right? Is it alma mater?
I say alma mater.
I think what I said was in between mater and mater, so we'll just go with that.
It was. It was like a very Norwegian sounding vowel. It was kind of like slidey and in between Norwegian and English.
Very non-committal, like I'm not really sure how to pronounce this word kind of vowel.
It could be. That too. That's another way to look at it.
Yeah. So, her name is Sam Pratt, and she's going to start working with me in June. And one of the projects we're going to work on together, I had this idea last summer for an anthology. It'd basically be like a fake magazine dated 50 years from now that is themed around a gender-inclusive future. And what that might look like and how we might talk about gender like 50 years from now. So I'm super excited about that, and I've gotten a lot of encouragement around that project, so I can't wait to see what happens with it.
Yeah, that's a really unique project. That sounds awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, you know how much I like speculative fiction.
Yes.
And because it's set 50 years in the future, of course, that's what it's going to be, the whole thing. But yeah, so that is hopefully going to happen. We're going to pitch it to a small press, a micro press, actually. And if that doesn't work out, I'll find some other way to fund it, because I definitely want to be able to pay contributors for that.
Right.
So how about you? What's up with you?
Oh, you know, working with my RevPit winner as well, going really well. I'm working with Lisa Bordeaux on her manuscript for Adrift, which is awesome. It's suspense, which is really, it's not what I would have saw myself, you know, picking, because I was trending a lot toward like sci-fi this year. I was really like banking on a sci-fi story, but Lisa's really just, it pulled me in right away. It was actually one of the first submissions I received, and it just hung with me like the whole time. I was reading every other sub and I was like, I don't know, I keep drifting back to this one, but it's really neat. I mean, the premise for it is that this woman kind of comes to on a boat in the Pacific Northwest, on the I guess it would be the Southwest because it's on the Canadian side, and her memory has been wiped. And all she has is a note is an unsigned note telling her that she is not to go looking for the person she once was, and that this was done to protect her.
Oh, and I just got chills.
Yeah, it's really cool. And it's got a lot of the themes really speak to me too. There's just so much in there about identity and, you know, what percentage of who we are as a person that we define for ourselves versus how the world defines us, and how we're defined by our past, or like what we want to get out of our future. And so it's got this really awesome upmarket appeal, and I'm really excited. We're about to do a full second pass on the manuscript now, and I'm so ready to see what she's made for changes now, and I want to get like real nitty gritty now with it, which is going to be great. So
that sounds awesome. I would totally read that.
Yeah, aside from RevPit stuff, it's going to be a very busy month. Morning Dove, the second book in my Empathy series, came out on April 29th.
Ooh, yeah.
So I'm very excited about that. And the thing that's really got me, aside from like, this book was different for some reason, like actually holding this one in my hands impacted me differently than either was the case for Accounting for It All or Imminent Dawn. And I don't know what it is about that, but I just got some good vibes, and I'm going to be bringing those vibes on tour, actually across Wisconsin. I might have mentioned this in the last episode a little bit, but yeah, I'll be in Eau Claire on May 11th for the official kickoff for Morning Dove. That will be at Daughters Books in Eau Claire. Then Madison, I'll be at Wisconsin Memorial Day weekend. I'll be in La Crosse on June 1st at Pearl Street Books, and then in Green Bay on June 8th at the Reader's Loft, which is a really cool bookstore. They have two live-in cats at that bookstore. And the owners of that location also put on the Untitled Town Conference, which is a conference that's free every year in the area. It's a really big one. Yeah, they get a ton of grants for it. It's awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah. It's a writers conference?
It's like a writers conference, and they have things there for readers as well. And I really wanted to go this year, but we had our housewarming here for our new home on the same weekend. So didn't quite work out, but next year, Untitled Town, I'm coming. Watch out.
Yeah, that sounds rad.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to everything that we got ahead here for the next month or so. But let's look ahead now maybe to the conversation. We're talking about inciting incidents today, of course. And as always, we might as well start by defining what it is we're actually going to talk about here. So what are inciting incidents? We had some input here from Cass over on Twitter. Would you like to read Cass's tweet? Would you like me to take that one?
No, yeah, I got it. So CassFic is on Twitter at CM_Fick, F-I-C-K. And she defines the inciting incident as the event in the story that kicks it all off, something that changes the MC's world, the main character's world, in some way.
And how do you feel that definition fits with what your definition of an inciting incident might be?
Yes, what she's describing there, I definitely would agree is an inciting incident. My definition, as you may know by now, is a little different. I think of two inciting incidents. Mm-hmm. And one of them is like sort of the first little hint of the primary conflict. The primary conflict's probably not even really clear at that point, and the main character can sort of ignore it. Like, maybe it disturbs them, but they don't have to react to it. They're not setting a goal in response to it. And that usually, it can happen either before, during, or after the first five pages. But it's, I find it really effective when it's at least hinted at in those first five pages. So that's the first inciting for me. And then that's sometimes also called, I think, the hook in other, yeah, the nomenclature for other structure models call it the hook. And then the second inciting incident is what Cass is talking about for me. It's the event that kicks off the primary conflict. It forces the main character to act. And part of that reaction is to set a goal that drives the narrative up into a certain point. It could be up until the first turning point. It could be till the midpoint. It could be till the darkest moment. It just depends on what the dynamics of that plot are. But so that's how I think about it. How about you?
Yeah, I think that I am. So you, of course, frame it through this way of having, you know, two inciting incidents. We have our first and we have our second. I like to think of it in terms of just one inciting incident. But I think as we kind of discussed during our RightsCast chat, it kind of comes down to nomenclature to an extent. You know, what you might call your second inciting incident, I might look at and call the first plot point. Or in the hero's journey structure, I think we'd call that the crossing of the threshold moment, where, you know, we're really now off on our adventure at this second inciting incident. We have a strong sense of the trajectory for the manuscript as a whole, and there's no turning back at this point for our main character. What I like to think of in terms of inciting incidents, though, is more of, it's a little bit more in line with what Cass had to say. It's sort of this disturbance in the force that does, in fact, suggest a direction that we might head. So it could, to your point, the first inciting incident in your model is sort of it covers us up through like that refusal of the call, where like we have our character in their ordinary world. There's a call to action, and I kind of see that as maybe being the inciting incident. But if we're going to use this two inciting incident model, I think the inciting incident kind of could cover us through the call to action, through the refusal of that call. And then we get a little bit of the lingering tension that builds up to the moment where they finally cross that threshold. So,
yeah.
My definition of it, I guess, is a little messier because it really depends on the plot structure model that you kind of want to take and run with here. I just like to think of the inciting incident as sort of, it's that hook that gives you that sense of direction for the primary conflict, and not just a hook for the sake of having a hook. We do need some connectivity, I think, to that primary conflict.
So if I'm understanding correctly, the inciting incident for you is that first hint in the beginning. Right. And then what I'm calling the second inciting incident, you would call the first plot point.
Yeah. Or I would look at that as crossing the threshold and like the hero's journey model.
Right. Crossing. Yes. But you see that initial inciting incident at the beginning as something that drives. I'm not remembering your terminology now.
Yeah, so it's kind of the call to action, right? If you were using a strictly, you know, hero's journey model. But it otherwise is inciting, it's a disturbance to the character's ordinary world that's going to give a suggestion of what that journey is going to look like. And it might even just be like a sense of, I have got some sample inciting incidents prepared for later. It might be an example of just what we're going to get thematically in terms of like what you can expect thematically here. We might get that, some of that bleeding into like that hook. Or that first inciting, if we want to put it that way.
So do you see it as like an actual event? Like, is it a thing that happens?
Yeah, I certainly see it as a thing that happens. I guess my question on that point might be, if it's not a thing that happens, what would the alternative be?
Right. Well, I guess because you said that it could be something that hints at the themes, and I think there are lots of ways to hint at themes. And this is also why I personally call it first inciting rather than a hook, is because there are lots of ways to hook a reader. We talk about hooking the reader in the first five pages. And right. So just for like clarity of terminology, because you can hook readers with, you know, a great sentence, with a voice, with, you know, a character they love, but that's not, it's not a thing that happens. It's not a plot point. And I could see how introduction of the themes could come through in, you know, world building and the premise itself, but not necessarily in a particular thing that happens. So I'm just trying to understand how you think about that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think specifically for the sample that I have prepared, it is tied to an event. And I do think that the inciting incident, I guess, to put a little bit more of a broader stamp on it, I do think that it has to be an event. You know, it's not going to be just a line of dialogue that hints at theme, for example. I think it really does need to be an occurrence. It needs to be a disturbance to that ordinary world. It's something physical that is happening on the page to our character and pulling them or nudging them in a particular direction.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. So even if at that point they're resisting that pull in that direction, there's still, as you said, yeah, there's still the movement there.
Yeah, there's still a suggestion. It's like a building of, I don't know, a wave. Like, I don't know, maybe if you're into surfing, which I'm not, so this metaphor might not be very good. It's kind of like when you first start to catch the wave, you've got a sense of momentum. Whether you're going to be able to hang in there is like another matter entirely, but you're definitely being pushed in a direction and it can only build from there, right? Probably. I don't know. I live in the Midwest. I don't surf.
I think that works. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Right. Like that you can hang in there for this one, but the next wave is the one you can't swim through. And I don't surf either, obviously.
All right. Yeah, I like that. We're just going to roll with this. We're doing only surfing metaphors. It is so decreed for episode 14 of Novel Approaches. Surf's up, folks.
Okay, so I think I got that. Thank you for helping me understand.
Thank you for helping me understand myself, because I was pretty muddled.
Well, that's part of what I love about these conversations is like you ask me questions that I hadn't thought to ask myself and vice versa. And I think we end up, even if we don't end up in the same place with the same definitions, we end up with more clarity about our own perspectives. And that's right. That's the whole awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So why are inciting incidents important?
They are important, I think, for some of what we just said. In fact, they provide that first real strong sense of momentum. It's that little nudge. It's a suggestion of the journey our character is going to be on. And that's super important. We don't want to create a sense of extraordinary stagnation to kick things off, which I think is something that I know in my earliest days as a writer and as working as an editor, it's something I think you see sometimes from clients is there's this idea that we really want to make sure we present the ordinary world strongly because we need to give you a sense of who these people are and where they are and what their circumstances might be. But if we linger for too long, it starts to feel like, all right, I've got a quicksand feeling here. We're just kind of sinking. And that's certainly momentum, but it's not momentum forward. It's momentum, you know, downward, we're stuck in the mud, so to speak. So I think that inciting incidents are really important because they're going to provide that sense of like, all right, there is in fact going to be a story here. We will be capitalizing on the premise that has been promised in our book's description, and we are now in a position to better appreciate where we might go from here.
It's like you just said what I wrote in my blog post. I don't know if you even read it, but
oh my God, is it really? I read it like right before we recorded, so it might have been fresh in my head, and I am so sorry.
No, that's totally fine. I'm just like, yep, absolutely. Hey, great. Hey, that sounds really familiar.
That is funny. Oh man, now I'm like, oh man, maybe I should. I told myself I wanted to read the post before we sat down for this conversation because I know that you and I kind of look at inciting incidents differently in terms of, yeah, you know, the number of them, etc. So I was like, well, I kind of want to know what am I getting into here when Sion and I talk about this? So maybe I should have left it to the side and just unbiased myself, but
I agree with you completely. I think the first inciting incident is essential for providing that sense of forward momentum in those pages. And I have, you know, and this kind of gets on to the second point, the second question, part of this question is how many should our stories have? And I have seen books that have an effective structure that don't have the first inciting at all. They start at the second sighting. And I think that can be really, really an exciting choice. I think that it's much harder. It just makes your job harder as an author to work all the information that you need to work in, because you don't have that, like, what I think of as act one setup time. But some stories don't need it. Like the example that I mentioned in my blog post is murder mysteries. Some murder mysteries do have the setup, but others start with a dead body or the crime being committed, and there's no setup there. And actually, the way that they were, I thought about it later, and I was like, the information's there. It's just that the story is about uncovering it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of why that works so well, is because the whole rest of the story is about figuring out the background information, that setup that caused this event, if that makes sense. I feel like I'm babbling, so I'm going to turn it over to you.
No, that makes a lot of sense, because if you think about it, particularly in the framework of a mystery, there's this attempt to recover the ordinary world and the people that are being thrust into the situation that, you know, who are the ones who need to uncover this and recover that ordinary world, they weren't familiar with it themselves. So if we present it to the reader, we're going to have dramatic irony the whole time, which could be, you know, could be effective, because dramatic irony is cool. But also, I think folks who are looking to read mysteries are looking for it for the mystery. You know, they want to be in a position to solve it alongside the detective, for example, or whoever it might be. They don't want to, like, kind of know what happened and watch someone try to figure it out. I mean, that could be done effectively, but I guess it's probably not a genre convention.
I love the way that you phrase that, recover the ordinary world. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but I think you're absolutely right. And that process involves not only figuring out who committed the crime, but also bringing them to justice, which is why if there's no justice in the end, it feels very, for me personally, very unsatisfying. But yeah, recovery. The ordinary world. And I like that.
Yeah, it's something too that if people are interested in learning more about that, because I think there's an argument, maybe not an argument, but there's a framework for structure that's like circular structure. And I think we might have talked about this on one of the older novel approaches episodes, but this idea.
In the script episode, in fact.
Yes, it was. They had plot and structure, I believe. But yeah, it was. The idea that all storytelling is cyclical, and you have like this one great wheel that your primary conflict is walking characters through, that you ultimately kind of end up back where you were, but changed. But then within the course of the story, you have, it's kind of like the inside of an old clock where there's all these little gears. There are so many smaller circles that are helping churn this larger one to get you back to recovering that ordinary world, but you're different. It's like recovering the ordinary, but different now, kind of thing. Four people, one study, the internet access brain implant to bind or destroy them all. Now available in print and ebook from author R.R. Campbell and Nine Star Press, it's Imminent Dawn, the first book in the epic empathy sci-fi saga. Learn more about the book reviewers are calling freaking sci-fi Game of Thrones and an incisive techno thriller that gets more tense with every page by visiting empathyseries.com. That's empathyseries.com. I think we're good. We've kind of covered why inciting incidents are important, you think? I feel like we kind of nailed that one down.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the first one in particular is what we talked about. And then what I call a second inciting, the one that kicks off the plot, what you call the threshold moment. I think that's, I can't imagine a book that doesn't have a moment that kicks off the primary conflict. I mean, that is the definition that I'm giving, right?
Yeah.
So if you had a book that didn't ever kick off the primary conflict, what is that?
I don't know. Literary fiction? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, rude.
I know. I just had to. I think it's what some people have as an idea of literary fiction.
Yeah. Well, and I can see why in reading literary fiction sometimes, if we're talking about like contemporary fiction, why it might seem like that, because a lot of them are very like intensely character focused.
Yep.
But even in those, there are definitely inciting incidents.
Yeah, and there's, of course, the arc is just more about that character change through perhaps more subtle and smaller matters, as opposed to, like, I am a hero and I am on a quest kind of thing.
100%. Yeah, it's, yeah, for Litfic, the primary conflict is most often the character's internal conflict.
Sorry, I was digging for a transition there and I just lost the thread.
Oh, I thought you were trying to come up with a surfing metaphor.
Yeah, I know. Maybe next time I'll have a surfing metaphor. Coulda, woulda, shoulda. Oh, here's a good surfing metaphor.
Oh, no.
So let's say you're a totally rad dude and you're out on your board catching some waves and you're trying to figure out, you know, is this the wave I want to catch? Does it have the right shape, so to speak? Oh, hey, good transition. It's time to segue. What shapes do inciting incidents take? I can read the answer here this time, actually. I'll hop in on this one. This is from E, as in the letter E, who tweets at EWC_Cooper over on Twitter. E mentions this about the shapes that inciting incidents take. I write mysteries, and a point of interest for me is how a person becomes a killer or a murder victim. The first inciting moment is the one where I can explore that pivot and insert agency into my characters while kicking the plot off. So just an example of what you might get in a mystery. I know we spoke about mystery for a couple minutes earlier, but that is an example of a shape that an inciting incident could take. It's kind of that, it's that murder moment, for example.
Well, and spoiler alert, E is actually my client and I've worked on this book. So, and she has one of those books where there actually is a first inciting, meaning the book does not open on the murder. The murder happens around page 50.
Wow.
And so there is a lead up to that, you know, introduces the main characters and their conflicts with each other and the murder victim and some of the background and that kind of thing. And so that's the lens through which I'm reading her tweet. Yeah. And so I see her talking about, like, the moment at which someone becomes a murderer, basically.
That is interesting. 'Cause then we're following in a story like that, and tell me whether this is or isn't the case, I guess. In a story like that, it almost sounds like we are not following the detective who's trying to recover that ordinary world, but the murderer and the journey that they are now on for having committed this murder. Does that seem right?
In this particular instance, it is neither.
Wow. Interesting. I feel like it's going to really require some serious spoilers to cover something like that.
Yeah. The main character is someone else. And yeah, so I don't want to spoil it. But
here's something that actually I can offer that might kind of fall into the category I was describing, though. I don't know if you watch the show Barry on HBO at all. But so you have the main character is Bill Hader, and he plays a hitman, and it's a dark comedy, right? So that's kind of the tone of this show. And he is trying to make it as an actor out in Hollywood, and he can't escape this world of, like, getting paid to do these hits on people, right? So you kind of watch Barry's journey unfold as, like, this guy who wants to get out of the murder business, but really can't. His situation just keeps spiraling and getting worse and worse, and he just feels so trapped. And while you're watching him go on that emotional journey and that personal journey of trying to come around the right way, so to speak, you're also watching a series of detectives try to recover the ordinary world. So you kind of get this meet in the middle where it's a really nice dynamic because, of course, with television, you can do that multi-POV stuff a lot, quote unquote, easier anyway.
Yeah. Well, what you're talking about reminds me a little bit of Tin Star, which I think is on Amazon or Hulu or somewhere. It's somewhere. It's got Tim Roth I love Tim Roth. Isn't that his name? I'm going to have to look that up in a minute. But yeah. And so in the beginning, it's this guy, British guy, moves to a small Canadian town with his family, and he's the new sheriff. But you find out fairly quickly that, I'm not going to give everything away here, but he was a criminal in his past, And so his criminal past catches up with him in this new setting that he was trying to escape. And it's a wonderful, continuous downward spiral for the entire first season. It's great.
Hmm. It is, in fact, Tim Roth. I looked that up there. So Tin Star. Yeah. Looks interesting. Very cool. Well, so okay. we've got a little on, yes, the shape of inciting incidents, right? How are you feeling on this one? What shapes do inciting incidents take for you?
Well, this was a question that you came up with, and I'm really curious to hear your answer so that I have a sense of like what do you mean what shape? What you talking about, Ryan?
Yeah, I can certainly go ahead with that, because I think the point that I really want to drive home in this section is that an inciting incident doesn't have to be like, we've talked about it a lot in the context of like a murder mystery, right? And so there's a murder. You know, mm-hmm. it's a big explosive moment. There's like something very dramatic happens to a person. And yeah, that's a really effective hook, though I don't want to have to use that word, because as we've covered, you know, hook can be many different things, but it's a really effective way to get readers into the story. It creates a strong sense of momentum, but we don't always need these big explosive moments to serve as our inciting incidents, particularly if the story we're writing doesn't necessarily call for a big explosive moment. So what I thought would kind of be a nice exercise would be for me to share two very contrasting inciting incidents, or what I would see as inciting incidents, and we can kind of get a feel for this dynamic that I'm setting up here, where we have one that is going to be a very explosive, big, you know, moment on the page to draw readers in. Another is a much quieter, more subtle, but very menacing way to draw readers in. So
do it.
I'm going to go ahead and read from Tess Sharp's Far From You. I won't read from the back cover, because you're pretty much going to get the contents of the back cover in the first few sentences of the book. So Chapter 1 for Tess Sharp's Far From You starts with, "It doesn't start here. You'd think it would. Two terrified girls in the middle of nowhere, cowering together, eyes bulging at the gun in his hand. But it doesn't start here. It starts the first time I almost die." That's it. That's what I consider to be the inciting incident in this book, because it gives you a sense of where everything in the story is going to head from here, right? We're set up right away with, we know that this character is in a position a couple of times where they're going to die. We have this idea that some man has had a gun in his hand. It has been put on our main character. We're going to need to know who this man is, why he's doing this, what led these two women to be in this position in the first place. It raises a ton of questions, and it turns out to be tied directly into the primary conflict and the central question, which is, as we learn later in the book, he was wearing a mask. We don't know who this guy is. And it's all part of like uncovering that mystery and working back to an ordinary world, though our character knows the whole time what their ordinary world was. We're just working to like a different version of it or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I have to say, that was very hooky and chilling.
Yes, right. Chilling in a very in your face, like, wow, this is some high stakes business right away.
Yes, literally life or death.
Yep. And we'll contrast that with A Thousand Splendid Suns by Khaled Hosseini, who also wrote The Kite Runner. More people might be a little more familiar with that title, but A Thousand Splendid Suns, also a phenomenal book. The first episode of Biblio Breakdown focuses on this book exclusively for like a half hour, so it obviously got my brain churning in a lot of the right ways. One thing I don't really think I cover at all in that episode, though, is the book's inciting incident, which I kind of want to share because, again, it contrasts with the inciting from Far From You, because in this one we have a much more subtle, you can really almost miss it. We'll see if you catch it as I read, but here we go. Miriam was 5 years old the first time she heard the word harami. It happened on a Thursday. It must have, because Miriam remembered that she had been restless and preoccupied that day, the way she was only on Thursdays, the day when Jaleel visited her at the Kolba. To pass the time until the moment that she would see him at last, crossing the knee-high grass in the clearing and waving, Miriam had climbed a chair and taken down her mother's Chinese tea set. The tea set was the sole relic that Miriam's mother, Nana, had of her own mother, who had died when Nana was two. Nana cherished each blue and white porcelain piece, the graceful curve of the pot's spout, the hand-painted finches and chrysanthemums, the dragon on the sugar bowl, meant to ward off evil. It was this last piece that slipped from Miriam's fingers that fell to the wooden floorboards of the kolba and shattered.
I think I'm picking up what you're putting down. The destruction of the piece that was meant to ward off evil. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, this is a crossing of the threshold moment, and it's happening for our character at an age when they're super young. They don't understand the consequences of what they're doing, and whether you believe in the lore behind this particular porcelain, you know, dragon or not, it's still going to have an impact. And the reason that this is such a powerful inciting incident for me is because it ties so strongly into the story's themes and to what its central conflict is. Because this book ultimately is about whether our main character, whether Miriam can escape tradition and the weight of history and everything that, you know, those two factors impose on her and Afghan women in particular. Like, that's really what this story is about. And it also ties into, it does that by tying it into like theme and folklore and like legend and what it is that the value that we attribute to simple things in our lives, and how if you're a true believer that this dragon, you know, was meant to ward off evil and you have broken it, welcome to your new reality, right? So it's a very subtle, quiet moment. Again, you could miss it because it's right at the end of the first page and the chapter goes on for some time. But I circled back to that at one point and was just like, oh man, that's the whole thing. It really sets us up for the whole story and what we can expect to happen to Miriam from here on out.
Yeah, I think that's a really great example of a very subtle first inciting incident. And I definitely see how when you were talking earlier about setting up themes too, I see how that action, that event is a symbol for the themes that you were talking about in this book.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and it carries all the way through both for Miriam and for the other main character that we follow.
I'm curious, if you don't mind circling back to Far From You, do we have time for that?
Yeah, we got some time.
Because, and I haven't read the book, so I don't really know what I'm talking about, but just based on what you read, it sounds to me like it starts in medias res.
Yeah, and that's, I'm curious about that too, right? Because the way that we're set up for this scene is by saying that it doesn't start here, and then we're provided with something that is, you know, the middle of a scene. We're very much in the middle of action. But as we go on to find out, it's not happening, you know, in time with where our character actually is in her life right now. It's looking back on a past moment, right? Which is still in media res, but it's not something that she's experienced at that exact moment. She's recalling it from the future.
Okay. So the moment where she and the other woman are being held at gunpoint is not the quote-unquote present from which the story is being told. Is that correct?
Yeah.
What I would expect, and I'm curious to see if I'm right about this, I would expect that from that beginning, we would go back to the, what she's calling like the true beginning, and lead up to probably a midpoint where she's being held at gunpoint by the masked man, and then go on from there to a resolution at the end. Is that sort of accurate?
And I read this book, I think, a couple of years ago by now, but I think that's pretty much the structure overall. Is we literally, I mean, we go from the last line of the first scene. I mean, what I read, that's the entire first scene of the book. That scene ends with, it starts the first time I almost die. Page break. The first time I'm 14, ... And we go right into the first time she almost died. That puts us on a trajectory to like get a real feel for the kind of person she is and what she's been through. We build up to like what happened with the masked man. And then the final, I think it's more like the final third of the book is all about, you know, finally getting the pieces together that we need to figure out that mystery.
Got it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's a great book. I mean, there's a reason that I just saw here. I mean, it was in the 2015 Rainbow List top 10, and it was one of Kirkus's best teen books for 2014. So it's a great book. I'd encourage anyone to read it just for its inciting incident. And also, I mean, it's an awesome romantic suspense.
So I would like, I'm just trying to, like, so I'm thinking about, again, not having read the book, but just hearing what you're saying about it and what I would identify as the first inciting would be that story about what happened when she was 14, the first time she almost died. Yeah. Even though it's not told in that, like, even though we start in a future moment, in terms of what the first inciting event is for that plot line. Do you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I do. I do see what you're trying to say. I think that the difference for me would be that the first paragraph here, which focuses on the more future moment, ties into the mystery at the heart of the book a little bit more. Whereas this second, you know, the second paragraph, which is about the first time that she almost died, it's not about that mystery. It's more about, it's kind of introducing the main players that will become part of the romance angle of the book, but in a really important way too. So it's like we're getting the two, if we're talking about it in terms of romantic suspense, we're kind of being given an inciting incident for the suspense angle of the book first and foremost, then we're sliding immediately into an inciting incident that's going to kick off the dynamics of the romantic angle to it too.
Genius.
Yeah, it's a great book. You don't need to hype up books a lot on this podcast probably, but it's a really good book.
Former adult film star Robin Weathers has skated by as Pornucopia's do-nothing accountant for years. And who can blame her? Her supervisor has only encouraged her dilly-dallying, and it's given her oodles of time to do what she loves most, coach the talent at her mentor's feminist pornography studio. But then the IRS comes knocking. With her supervisor unable to bail her out, Robin can either come clean and risk her friendships and career, or buck up and find another way to skirt the system. No matter how she chooses, along the way she'll have to confront her blossoming feelings for the man she's enlisted to teach her accounting, and the return of the woman she's always loved, who's finally ready to try to make things work. Accounting for It All by R.R. Campbell, now available in print and ebook wherever books are sold. For more, visit accountingforitall.com. That's accountingforitall.com. Thanks for listening.
Well, and I had missed the part that it was romantic suspense.
Yeah, I didn't mention that till later, so that's my bad.
No, so, and I think that's really important because you have to follow the conventions of romance as well as the conventions of suspense. It's one of the reasons that I find that genre so exciting, and also it would be really difficult to write. You know, you've written one. But yeah, and so I really love what you're saying about how the author first introduced the suspense plot. That's how it's first introduced. And so I see why you're calling that first inciting. And then the romance angle.
And this this ties in really nicely to the next question we have on for this conversation, which is how do we write inciting incidents effectively? And so, for example, in something like a romantic suspense, we might see this sort of like dual or tandem set of inciting incidents that, you know, eventually as the plots become more intertwined, as the romance becomes more, you know, connected to the suspense, these plot lines sort of merge, but we might start with these two sort of like disparate threads that eventually weave together like DNA or something like that. And I don't have a good surfing metaphor for this, so we're going with DNA.
You're surfing a DNA strand. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, okay. So this is on how can we write inciting incidents effectively? Is that where we are?
That is correct.
What should we keep in mind? Well, if you don't mind, I'll read Cass's answer. So this is Cass Fick again. And she says, this one is tough to explain. I feel like the inciting incident needs to be tied to the primary conflict so the reader isn't confused when another different goal presents itself. There should be logical steps, and the inciting incident should be the first of those steps, is how I understand that.
Yeah, it's kind of like a mini goal. It might introduce a mini goal that's going to lead us to the bigger goal, but it is integrally tied to the bigger goal kind of thing, if we're kind of going to talk about it in terms of steps.
Well, and Cass is talking about, like, so her definition of inciting incident is what I call the second inciting incident, what you might call the threshold moment. So I think it's important to keep how she thinks of it clear
yeah.
for understanding the context of that. So, yeah. Do you agree that it needs to be tied to the primary conflict?
I think it's going to be strongest when it is. Otherwise, it could come across as, I just need a big moment to happen to get you interested in the story. And if it doesn't prove to be especially connected to the primary conflict, even if it's, you know, I think we can get away with having an event occurs that feels a little removed from it, but later we reflect and realize that it was necessary to put our character on this journey. I think that's fair game. But if you truly have an inciting incident that is just existing in isolation, say it's a surfer who has swum out to sea and there are no waves to catch, for example, then what are we doing? You know, you just swam out to sea and no one saw you do any cool surfing, and you come back later with a cool story about how you fought off a shark and no one believes you, and what was the point?
So what comes up for me when you're talking about that is a structure for Act One that I think of as the mini mission structure, where the main character starts out with an urgent goal. It can be actually like a very exciting thing where they're trying to sneak into the museum to steal the painting, blah, 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 you know, whatever's happening. And the conclusion of that mission, that mini mission, is what catapults them into the primary conflict. Whether or not the primary conflict is directly tied to the mini mission itself, I'm just doing a terrible job of explaining what I'm talking about here. So, I guess what I'm saying is, like, I think you can have a first inciting that is not directly tied to the primary conflict if the second inciting, which this is also why I think of them as first and second inciting, is bookending Act One. Because the first inciting has to be connected to the second inciting, and the second inciting has to be connected to the primary conflict. But you could have a situation where the first inciting is not directly connected to the primary conflict. Did that make sense?
So I'm following you with, like, the journey for how you were building the argument, but then at the end it almost felt like it was circular, because we were maybe saying that we can have a first inciting incident that isn't tied to the central question because we can have a first inciting incident that isn't tied to the central question. Maybe I just misunderstood, but it felt a little tautological.
Well, look at you with your $50 words. Huzzah! Okay. So the first inciting is we learn that the main character is trying to steal the painting from the museum. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a really terrible example, but hopefully it'll do the trick. And so they end up, you know, 50 pages, you know, in, and the, or 30 or whatever. So they either succeed or fail at stealing that painting. And then they meet the love interest. And it turns out that this book is about the romance. And there's also this whole, like, thief angle, right? This is why I said it's going to be a terrible example, because you would never do that for romance.
Right. You wouldn't do it for a romance, but I think you could apply, you know, that principle to a different, think of it in any, you know, different dimension aside from a romance. And maybe, oh man, that's challenging.
I could have chosen any other genre. No, no, no.
I'm not saying you could have. I'm saying listeners fill in, you know, whatever genre would make more sense to them or that they're more familiar with. I think the struggle I'm having is, like, I believe that that could be done effectively, but as a reader and as an editor, I would die inside if someone did that to me, just like as I was reading a book. And I don't know if it's like a me thing or what, but I feel so strongly that your novel's opening pages, that, like, your book description, that all of it is a promise. You are promising me a particular story. And if I get to a certain juncture and suddenly it's like, well, I know you signed up for this heist, like, thief thing, but we're really going to focus on, you know, totally different element. I'm going to be like, well, what did I read 50 pages for? You know, that would be my feeling as a reader anyway.
Mm-hmm. I totally get that. I felt that with Diamond Age. Neal Stephenson's Diamond Age. It's a sci-fi book where the first 50 pages are about this dude that has all of these tech implants and he's on trial and stuff. And then it turns out that the real story is about his daughter.
Oh.
And he's like, well, why did I have to read 50 pages about that dude?
Right. It feels kind of, I don't know. I'd be very upset. If I have to imagine that if I were just a reader and we'll say, I'm taking off my editor hat, I'm taking off my writer hat. If I grab a book and I read, you know, through the first 50 pages and suddenly it's a different story, that book is going to be a DNF for me because you have violated my trust to such an extent that, like, I cannot trust what you're going to present me with for the remainder of this book. With the exception, here we go, exception time, David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas. Something that's a speculative work of fiction where you kind of know part of the conceit is that you're going to get shifting storylines that will, like, change emphasis points to ultimately create a broader narrative that's, you know, centered around something more thematic. Like, that might be an exception, but again, you would hopefully know you're getting into that judging by the book description.
Okay. I don't know how to, so like I said, the example I gave was terrible. I knew it was going to be, here's what I say is, like, I've actually worked on two books that have done this really well.
And that's, I believe it.
Possible.
Right. It's one of those things where it's like, I imagine that it could be done super well. I'm just like, maybe it's a trust issue with me. Let's turn it into a deeper identity concern that I need to see a therapist about, where my trust issues preclude me from being interested or following through with books that trick me in such a way.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a really relevant point. And it causes me to think about what was it about the promises in those first 50 pages that made those two books work for me,
right?
Even though the primary conflict was, like, not really introduced until, you know, page 50 or whatever. And there was this whole little mini mission thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have to think about that some more.
Yeah, I'd be really curious to know, like, what the connectivity ultimately proves to be there, because as I kind of look at my notes, it's actually unsurprising that I had such a strong feeling about this question, because I framed this notion of writing an effective inciting incident through the lens of making sure that it's tied to the central question and the primary conflict, what have you. Because in both the books that I read earlier, you know, in Far From You and in A Thousand Splendid Suns, in Far From You, you have a big explosive moment for a book that's going to be full of suspense with really high personal stakes. And we get that in those five or six sentences. It's all right there. So a promise has been made. The promise is executed. It feels great. And then in A Thousand Splendid Suns, again, it's a quiet moment. It's very subtle. And that's kind of how the main character lives her life. She is subversive, but in these nice, subtle ways until suddenly, you know, she can no longer be so subtle about it. And they frame the story really nicely and they tie into the journey that the characters are on. And so those, to me, being particularly resonant inciting incidents just makes me feel like, oh, of course, it must be tied to our primary conflict. So I don't know. Maybe it's just the approach that I've taken to being an analytical reader that's led me to believe that, and also how I've approached it as a writer, because it's something that I did in both Imminent Dawn and Accounting for It All as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely think there's something to be said for, you know, like, general guideline for what we find most effective. And I think we've come back to this over and over in our conversations, is that there are no hard and fast rules, and
right.
There are ways to subvert conventions effectively. But if we're just talking about, like, the basics, then yes, I agree. Having a first inciting that's related to the primary conflict is important.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's a good way to think of this too, is if you're a writer who's listening to this podcast and you are just trying to get your feet wet and you want a nice guide to help you get through a first draft or revising what was your first draft, and you need something to kind of, like, check off or check in on, I would say, like you said, maybe try to keep some relationship between that first inciting and your central conflict. But if you're a writer who's, like, ready, or just you're going to do the most ambitious thing ever and you're going to pull out all the stops and subvert everything, like, go for it. Because, I mean, like you said, there are things that you have read that have done that really effectively, where the first inciting isn't tied to the central conflict, but that's like, you're getting drafted right out of high school and playing Major League Baseball. I should have gone with surfing. Dang it. What was I thinking? But It's like going from learning how to swim and barely being capable of swimming and deciding that you're going to enter a surfing competition. How about that?
Excellent.
There we go. And again, well, I hope that doesn't sound, you know, I really don't want that advice to sound exclusionary. I'm just trying to offer, you know, practical advice, because in writing, we really have to, at least from my experience anyway, I found that the only way I was ever to truly put a manuscript together that felt publication worthy and proved to be publication worthy was to go back to some of these basics and really get a nuanced understanding of what all of these topics were, and then just say, okay, I'm now going to write a book that literally just follows the underpinnings for things like structure in an A through Z way. And guess what? That's the book that got, you know, published. It got my foot in the door, and now I can have all sorts of fun by the time I get to the third book in the Empathy series and do whatever I want, because here we are. So I don't know. It's, you talk about like mini missions and mini quests, you know, it's like we gotta fight the minor bosses before we go into the dungeon master kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I do think that, so when I was first learning to write, I was very, write fiction, I should say. I was very bitter and resistant to, and not just fiction, but also academic writing too. It's like, why do I have to learn the conventions? Why can't I just like write what comes naturally to me and make it work? Because if it works, it works, right? That's the whole point.
Right.
And so I've definitely been in that mindset, and I hate to say it, past me, but you were wrong. Right. I really do think that there's a lot of value in learning the conventions so that you understand. It's, to me, it's all about readers' expectations. The conventions have dictated readers' expectations, whether or not they know that they have developed those expectations. And if you are going to subvert the conventions and therefore disappoint readers' expectations on certain points, then you have to know what those conventions are, what those expectations are, so that you can figure out how to set up different expectations.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. That's exactly, yeah, I guess what I meant to say, and you've framed it in a really nice way there. So I'm running out of surfing metaphors. I know I've been switching back to other things, but hang 10 or something. I don't know. Good job.
Thank you. I'm coming back to this question, what should we keep in mind when we're writing and citing incidents? And then, of course, I'm going to take it back to how I define those two inciting incidents. One of the things that I have seen in manuscripts that keeps major plot points from feeling like major plot points is that the main character does not set a goal in response to it. Now, I've already mentioned earlier in this conversation that I don't think that the character needs to set a goal in response to the first inciting incident, but they absolutely do in response to the second inciting incident. So that is one thing we haven't really talked about explicitly that I just wanted to add to the conversation.
Yeah, that's a good point, because at the juncture at which they are at this second inciting in the framework that, you know, you've worked with, I've also described it as that threshold, like they must have strong forward momentum. We do not want the character to be in a position where they can just walk away from their problem. And that, I think, in many cases necessarily entails the establishment of a goal, and a goal that they can actively be working toward, whether it's by themselves or with their allies or, you know, their temporary allies or what have you. I mean, I think once you get to that moment in a story, you are in like the heart, you are in the bread and butter, you are in the salt of the ocean with your surfing metaphor of storytelling, and we can't move forward unless we know what our character wants and what they're going to do to try to achieve that.
Yeah, and most often that goal that they set at the second sighting or just after the second sighting is different from, so the opening pages also need to have a character with a clear goal, I think. But that is the character's time of life goal, like what it is they, you know, sort of aspire to at this mm-hmm. time in their life, whether it's getting into this particular, you know, sword fighting school, or, you know, I don't know, being able to talk to their wife again, who's in a coma, or, you know,
yeah,
time of life goal. And then, and usually the second inciting incident, the goal set at that point, there might be a relationship between the two goals, but it's not the same. It's a different goal. It's like something has happened that is like a major obstacle or detour for that main character. They can't get back to their original goal until they take care of whatever it is that has happened. Do you see that too, or do you have a slightly different perspective on that?
For me, I mean, yeah, they need to have their focus trained on that most immediate thing. I guess an example that I can think of where we might have these dual plots where it's not their only focus after they get past the second inciting might be in something like a romantic suspense, for example. So I'll pull in Accounting for It All, which, full disclosure, my book, of course. But we have that moment where Robin is forced to cross this threshold where it's like, okay, you now know that there is an IRS audit incoming. You are extraordinarily incompetent, but you are the only person who is going to be able to take this on. And if you try to walk away, it's going to come at perhaps an even greater cost, you know, in her mind anyway, because it would require coming clean about a number of other things. And so we have that as sort of like the suspense angle to the plot, and that has to be her primary focus for the suspense angle of the plot. But we also have these romantic interests that are playing out on the side that, to some extent, particularly with her romantic interest with Dave, is tied into the suspense plot because he is someone who can help her with that specifically, whereas her relationship with Sarah is trying to kind of pull her away from that world, so we get an additional layer of tension there. So yeah, at the second inciting, we certainly need to be in a position where they can't walk away, and the challenge that's been laid before them is the challenge they're going to need to face, with the exception maybe being some of these mixed or like cross-genre works where there's going to be like a romance plot and there's going to be a suspense plot, and then we might get them focused on those things exclusively but kind of in tandem with one another.
Okay, not to put you on the spot, but a little bit to put you on the spot because I'm just curious. So when, and it's been a while since I read Accounting for It All,
mm-hmm,
but when the book opens, like in the first five pages before the first inciting incident, which happens fairly quickly, thankfully, what would you say Robin's time of life goal is?
Her time of life goal is to really settle into, it's framed right through the dimension of it, how it's Thursday. Thursdays are her favorite days. The things that she wants out of life are to continue to just get by, not really doing her accounting work, and do this sort of like consulting on the side, which she gets to do on her Thursdays. Like, that is her time of life goal. She is right back in the mix with her work, you know, having been a former porn star, that's as close as she's ever going to get to being back in that angle of the lifestyle. And it's a happy medium for her. And her goal is just to keep on keeping on. It's not an especially aspirational goal, I guess, because it isn't something she's working toward, but her time of life goal is to like maintain a strong status quo and live her best life, which she is already feels like she's very much living.
Yeah, well, and now that you're saying that, I'm remembering, like, I kind of wanted for her that she could spend more time consulting. I don't know if that was in there too, but where I'm going with this is like, so her time of life goal is she wants to spend as much time as possible consulting because she loves this kind of work so much. And the audit really doesn't have very much to do with that. But it's something that she must deal with if she's going to be able to go back to her time of life goal of consulting. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. There is a clear relationship between that. And I think that the first inciting actually is really what pushes us away from her time of life goal too, because the first inciting is the moment when we cross it's like page two or three. I mean, we cross the threshold where we don't quite know that the IRS audit is looming yet, but we do know that she is in a very tight position because the only person that could help her with her accounting work is no longer in the picture. And so it's a disturbance and it's a clear threat to her time of life goal, but it isn't as strong of a threat as we get at the second inciting.
But the second inciting goal is not the time of life goal.
No.
And that's my point.
Yes. Okay, sure. No, I understand. Okay, that makes sense to me. Yes.
It's something that they have to deal with in order to be free to go back to their time of life goal.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's about circling back.
Which may have changed by that point, but.
Yeah, it's about circling back to the time of life goal. That makes sense. Or as we framed it earlier, perhaps in the sense of like a mystery, it's that idea of reclaiming the ordinary world.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes. Okay. Whatever the new normal is going
to
be, right?
Right. Exactly. Getting back to the homeostasis for $50 words, please, Alex. Thank you.
That's more like a $25
word. Sure, but. I know. It was a reach. It wasn't quite tautological, but I was trying my hardest there. I wanted to have a really nice callback to push us through to the end here.
Well done.
So with that in mind, I think that about wraps it up for the actual meat of the conversation here. So as always, we will have opportunities for further engagement for our next episode of Novel Approaches. Once this episode is live, we will, on Twitter, put up a poll that will ask you, our listeners, what it is you want to hear us talk about next time around on the show. So we will have some topics laid out for you in that poll, and those topics are going to be fatal flaws, prologues, and epilogues, or still on the poll here for the third month running now, I believe, we will have third option storytelling, which again is all about pushing past, the cliche or the first idea that comes to mind and pursuing maybe not even the second thing that comes to mind, but the third, as well as putting our characters in a position to make decisions that, you know, break the rules of a binary choice that they might be presented with. Can they find that third option? And if they can, what does that mean for our stories and our characters? So again, you'll be able to choose between fatal flaws, third option storytelling, or prologues and epilogues. There'll also be an other option, so you can leave something in the comments if you want to get a topic in our queue of things to include in these polls going forward. And as usual, we will have a hashtag RightsCastChat on that listener-selected topic, so keep your eyes on the RightsCast Twitter feed at RightsCast and at RightsCast.net/blog for more information on the topic, date, and time for all of that. So thank you, listeners. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network.
For more writerly podcast content like this, visit RightsCast.net or follow us on Twitter at RightsCast. I'm also on Twitter at WriteLearnDream. I'd love to connect with you and hear what you're working on.
And I am over on Twitter as I am R.R. Campbell. And I want to say thank you as well, of course, to our patrons at patreon.com/rightscast, folks who pledge to contribute to our programming at $1, $2, or $3 per episode, or $1, $2, or $3 per month. They get access to some really fun perks, including RightsCast Network swag, got some nice 4x4 RightsCast stickers that I like to send out. There are discounts on my editing services at some of the higher levels of support. And you can get free critiques, your first 5 or 10 pages. And in fact, I got to send out a nice bunch of envelopes today to new patrons because we had a nice little boost here coming out of April into May, which means we are now actually only one patron away. We're one patron away from unlocking a fourth episode every month. So if you're listening to this and you want more, you know, we might do an extra Novel Approaches once in a while. We'll get an episode, an extra R.R. Campbell RightsCast, an extra Biblio Breakdown thrown in every month. Now's the time, folks. It's time to cross that threshold. Let's get one more patron in the door and we can make this work. So again, that's patreon.com/RightsCast.
We'd especially like to thank Laura Hazen and Kristen Oakley, whose contributions at the awesomest of awesomes, aka Wise Mentor level, earned the two of them shoutouts in every RightsCast Network episode, on top of all the other great patron rewards they receive.
Yeah, so again, become a patron. That's patreon.com/RightsCast. And next up on the RightsCast Network, we'll be back with an episode featuring MD New, in which I interview him about strategies for growing our readership locally. That was actually a really fun conversation. I'm super into that one. So it's May 17th. You can find that on rightscast.net or your preferred podcast streaming service.
Or if you're a patron like me, you would have gotten an email today saying it's already available to listen to, because when you're a patron, you get to listen to stuff early and without ads.
Yes, without ads too. And by the way, hey folks, you know, if you're listening to these podcasts and you're like, man, I don't really like these ads, you know what you could do? You could become a patron, or you could reach out to me at rightscast.net/advertise or /advertising quote, or email me directly at rightscast@gmail.com. And instead of listening to me talk about how you can advertise or about someone else's book or editing service or creative endeavor, I could be talking about yours. So reach out to me. We make it nice and cheap for you. Little as $10, less than $1 a month for a full year, you can get it at the cheapest option. It's a steal. I don't know why you're not doing it. So again,
I'm not doing it.
Right, rightscast@gmail.com, Sion. And you've got all my emails. You know how to get a hold of me.
I've got all your emails. We're going to have to talk about this later.
Right.
All right, that's it for this episode of Novel Approaches. Thank you so much for listening.
And until next time, you know what to do. Write on and write well.
This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net.